Our guest is a Yorta Yorta woman, a child of the stolen generation who was raised in the era of the White Australian policy, White Australia policy. Diane O'Brien's memoir, Daughter of the River Country, reveals a childhood with a loving Irish adoptive mother and a distant and abusive father. Her adoptive mum died when Diane was 14, and she was put in the Parramatta Girls' Home, not finding out she was Aboriginal until she was an adult and raising her own six children. The discovery led to her meeting her birth mother and finding out she's the descendant of an Aboriginal activist. Beginning life as a child of the stolen generation, Diane O'Brien describes herself as grassroots and someone who's always looked out for the underdog. Her adult life was marred with domestic violence, alcohol abuse and tragedy, but despite her troubles, she's been recognised for her community leadership and health programs for people in need. Now aged 75, Diane O'Brien is the chairperson of Mingaletta Corporation, which is an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community hub. She has 37 grandchildren and great-grandchildren, has previously been named New South Wales Grandmother of the Year, and is commonly known as Auntie Di.
Well, I was adopted. I was taken from my mother and then given to a doctor in Lockhart who gave me to his son. And they brought me up, so they were my Irish adopted parents. I couldn't have asked for a better mother. And then, so when she passed, she always said she was going to tell me a secret, but she wasn't going to take me to parks till I was 15. But she died when I was 14, so she didn't make it. She died in the April, and in the July I turned 15. So she held on all that time, but her heart was too weak.
You'd always thought you were Italian, yeah?
Yeah, Italian, Spanish, Maltese. I used to say to the kids, oh, if anyone asks, we're Heinz variety.
And how was it then that you were told that you were adopted? How did that happen?
That happened when I was sentenced. After the rape, I went to Parramatta Girls' Home. And then in the courthouse at Parramatta, my father said he wanted to disown me in the court. And the judge said, well, you can't disown an adopted child. And then I knew, put two and two together then, because I used to have feelings that I didn't belong. I belonged somewhere else. But it just answered and opened a lot of doors to how I grew up feeling this displacement.
When your beloved mother died at 14, your beloved adoptive mum died. Everything changed from there, yeah?
It was all in the first 12 months. So mum sheltered me from a lot of stuff and a lot of trust that I had in people that really took advantage of it.
Including from your father.
Yes.
A brutal, neglectful father. And then, as you mentioned, as a young woman, you were raped. And you were you were forced to marry that person, is that correct?
Yes, the matron at the hostel that we were in at Myee, she said that you got two choices. You either let your baby go to another home for 5 years and then you will join her later on, which wasn't going to happen because your bond's broken for starters. And then she said, or marry the rapist, who then you can run away from them when you're 19 and you won't be a state ward. So they were the two choices that I was given. So, of course, I took the other one because I wasn't going to lose my child.
That beautiful baby of yours, she was, as you write, an absolute rock in your life and in your family.
Yes. And she's sadly gone now at the age of 49.
You lost her in a car crash, I think.
Yes.
She'd been at the centre of your life for so long, and we should say this was through times where you endure so much abuse and hardship at the hands of so many people, Diane.
Yes, I know. I think it's just I just trusted people, and I thought I could change some people, but you can't force people to change. They have to change themselves.
Tell me about that girls' home. The Parramatta Girls' Home, and what you and others experienced there?
Well, there was girls in there that did get raped by different, people. I was told there wasn't. One lady rang me one day and said there was never any man officers in there. And I said, well, where did the men come from? Were they welfare officers or something? Because there was men there. They used to rip the girls out of the bed of a night and take them down somewhere. I was thrown in the dungeons, and we used to have our showers in the dungeons. And then as we come out, no doors, no privacy, no nothing. And as we come out of the showers, they'd ask us to open our towels so they could search our bodies for tattoos. We were locked in a room all day, had breakfast, dinner and tea there, and then sent to our wards. And in the ward, there was only like a 2-inch mattress on the floor. This was all on remand first before you went to the what I call the big house, and that was where the big girls were.
Thus, these experiences in your teens carried on in your 20s and 30s and moving around quite a lot and some quite abusive relationships. And how did you survive that? Was the focus always on, I've got to look after the children? Like, how did you survive this?
The kids, you know, no good for these kids to be brought up this way. I ran away a few times, but there was never any help. There was never anywhere to go. And so each time the second husband would find me, I went back because I couldn't go to work. I couldn't do anything. The only time we got freedom was when we got our house in Mount Druitt. And then I could go to work. My oldest girl was older and she could keep an eye on the baby. And he was 18 months old then. So that's the only freedom that we got. So we went through all that, and the first four kids went through horror until we moved to Mount Druitt. And then, you know, life was not a bed of roses, but it was better than we went through.
This was when you got a housing commission house, right, in Sydney, near Mount Druitt?
Yes. And that's when we stopped moving. We stayed there for 21 years.
Although you had six children of your own, why did you start working with the, you know, so-called lost or troubled kids in your neighbourhood? You straight away started reaching out to others, yeah?
Yes, because there was a lot of kids that were homeless and getting kicked out of home for something like running away or riding their motorbikes down the creek and the police would chase them. So in the end, the police, every Friday night, I'd make a big stew. And the kids that used to get into trouble used to come up our place for tea. And then the police in the end used to bring the homeless kids up there. So here you are, we got some more kids here. Oh, I'm running out of room.
What did they call you, the kids?
Oh, Lady Di.
Some others. Who else in the neighbourhood called you Black Mama?
Oh, yeah, well, the kids started, the younger kids, the Aboriginal kids called me Black Mama. But these other kids were non-Aboriginal kids, and they were, so it didn't matter to me what colour you were, but these little kids, their house got set on fire, and these little kids come running down and saying, Arnie, the house on fire. And I'd run up and have a look, and I was searching for the baby, and the baby was under all these clothes on the bed. And I heard this funny noise, and I said, what's that noise? It sounds like a cat. Anyway, I was underneath all the washing, this little baby, and he was only like 8 or 9 weeks old. So I rushed him to the hospital. I took him home first, and then when I gave him a bottle, it went straight through him. So I took him up to the hospital. And then I realised that people thought this child was my child, but it wasn't. And I thought, no, I found this little boy in this burning house. And the house, we put the fire out. The fridge was on fire. And they said, well, they knew him because the day before, another person brought one of the little boys up that was neglected because the mother was a drunk and she left the kids on their own with another drunk who was asleep on the lounge and then didn't jump up straight away for this fire. But the other five little kids ran down and told me. So I ended up with Jakey till he was 15 months.
A lot of the community kids you helped came from backgrounds where there was dysfunction and alcohol or drug abuse or abuse of many kinds. Yeah. I mean, someone who's been through and was going through the life that you had, it's perhaps not surprising you had your own issues with alcohol, yeah. Tell me about that battle for you.
There was help. You know, like our house was a safe house for these children to come to. And I could relate to them because I'd been there and done it. And then when I became a drug and alcohol counsellor, I had walked the same path as these kids. So I wasn't reading a textbook. I got my qualifications, but I still was, they knew me. I walked the walk, talked the talk, and I knew what they were going through. So I tried to have different strategies with these people to help them. Some worked, some didn't. The ones that did work have wrote me letters and said, you know, they've got decent jobs and they've bought homes and new cars and whatever, and without my help they wouldn't have done it. That's my pay. That's my happiness, to see that these kids have grown up to something. And I always tell them, stand up and be counted. Have confidence in yourself. Don't worry about what other people are thinking. It's there in your heart.
But like you, for many, was alcohol about trying to blot out this pain, the pain of the past?
Yes, the alcohol. I started with the alcohol in my 30s. I was a late drinker because my second fella never drank, but the third fella, he did drink. So what I used to do was pour the drink down the sink. But in the end, I thought, oh, gee, I tasted one of his drinks and it was scotch. And I thought, oh, fancy throwing that down the drain, you know, like that's a lot of money going down the drain. So I drank it and put cold tea in it so he wouldn't get drunk to bash me up. And then I realised that I got addicted to drinking then. Then I start to drink to stop the pain. You know, like if he flogged me, I was drunk, so I didn't feel it as much.
When was it that you started to search for your birth family?
I started searching when this school teacher come into the house and asked me to, would I collect the OS study for the kids to buy books and things? And I said, no, because we're not Aboriginal. And he said, what makes you think you're not Aboriginal? And I said, oh, well, there's no proof. I did ask my stepbrother once, what did he think I was? And he said, I think you might have been Aboriginal when Mum brought you home. So he started me off on the track because it was always in the background that I might have been, and I used to be an activist for Aboriginal people. But there was no proof. So he went away, and within that 12 months, he found out that I was the granddaughter of William Cooper, a great activist and a great human rights activist. And so how proud was I to know that I was the granddaughter of William Cooper? And he found where we came from at Cummeragunja, and then everything fell in place. I went down to meet my great-grandfather's sister in a nursing home, and then Uncle Boydie, his grandson, I met in Shepparton, and that all fell in place, and all these feelings I had, and, you know, people that looked like my Kevin that died, he always felt like he didn't belong either. And if he'd, you know, if he'd followed me through this journey, he might have been alive today.
What happened then? What was Link Up, please?
Link Up was the Aboriginal... it's an Aboriginal searching for families and that. Peter Reed and Kyle Edwards were one of the founders of Link Up, and the first case was a lady called Dixie, and they flew her to Northern Territory to find her people. And she was in her 60s when she found her people. So then the next one was me. So I was the second case. And they were fabulous. Hired a car for me to go to Melbourne to meet Auntie Sally. And then she told me a lot about my real mother. And then when I come across to Albury, I've met with Uncle Boydie. And we had, a talk there before I went to Shepparton. And they all knew that I existed, but they didn't know where I went to. And then I come back and tell the kids, because I always wanted the kids to know something behind me, like it isn't just me and my kids, because I had that circle and I wanted to sort of spread it out wider. So if anything happened to me, the kids would have cousins and aunties and uncles. And the first time I met my great uncle Manuel, my kids were real bewildered because we never had uncles and aunties and old people around us.
Can you possibly put into words the impact and the feeling of finally finding out all this about your heritage and finding these people?
Yes, which was an honour, you know, and we come from good blood and I always knew there was something behind us. You know, I always thought I didn't belong, that I was one out and we belong somewhere else. But it was a long journey. You know, I found a lot of people that weren't my real people when I put ads in the paper. And it was one man had six sisters, and one of his sisters was a prostitute and she had six children. And he thought I might have been one of hers. And I thought, and he lived in Dubbo, but it wasn't. That was a dead end, but it was still heading towards Cymru, which was funny in a way, because Dubbo's only a couple of hours away from Cymru in New South Wales.
There's a water theme here too, isn't there? When you find out, I think it was your maternal grandmother, was a Yorta Yorta woman from the banks of the Murray River in Victoria, and the whole clan lived in river country, yeah? Did that have a real impact on you as well?
Yes, because I was always near water. I love water, and it seems to soothe me. I could sit there. Like, I used to go fishing with my stepdad and my uncles and that, and just stare at the water. And even when I grew up, I was fishing, and that time with doing the activists, I had to stand in the water as the tall ships come in and reacted Captain Cook's landing in the 80s, I was standing in the water with the flag. And it was up to my waist and all I could think of was sharks. But I'd always been attracted to the water and it just calmed me down.
We are speaking to Diane O'Brien, author of Daughter of the River Country, a book about her extraordinary life. Life as a survivor, but also as a giver, and whose life has flourished over many years, particularly after she found out so much about her birth, family, and her Aboriginal heritage. You're listening to 9 to Noon on RNZ National. Diane, at age 38, I think, you meet your birth mother, Esme. How did that go?
Yeah, it went okay, but we were just like friends. Because I never grew up. She kept me still hidden for 15 years before she introduced me to my half-sisters. So it wasn't the same like I thought it would. Well, I actually wanted to find my real father because I had a good mother, you know, and no one could take her place. But I just thought I could have had a relationship with my real mother for my grandchildren, because they were her grandchildren and great-grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren. But she didn't seem to want to go down that path. So I sort of just didn't. I asked about my real father and she told me two lies. And then later on I found out that I was actually in the car park when he passed, and she said to me she was going up to see the uncle, which was my real father. So I sort of shied off, and I never, and the girls, they never invited us to their place for parties or birthday parties and that, but we always invited them up to our place, and only two used to come, and then, it just faded away, and they've had nothing to do with us. And they never knew they were Aboriginal till I was found. So they never knew their past either, and they didn't want to. To me, they were like people are only black when they want to be black. So I don't agree with people like that.
Diane, there's more sadnesses in life. There's the loss of another beloved child, and yes, you come after that to settle in River Country. Were you really feeling a strong pull of ancestral ties, or what was the significance of that move?
That I wanted to move to show the kids what a mission life was like, and this is our culture, this is what our people have grown up on. At first I thought I made a big mistake because we just come from Mount Druitt, and if you know anything about Mount Druitt in New South Wales, well, it used to be a really rough place in the 60s and 70s and 80s, but my kids survived all that, and they survived all the other terrible things that have happened to us. So I didn't think, oh, well, they can face Cymru, and they're meeting their real cousins and their real aunties and uncles. So we weren't born and bred there, so we weren't, like, some were accepted and some weren't. So they weren't very nice. And I used to say to people, make sure that you are welcome back when, you know, these kids have been stolen kids and stolen people, and they go back thinking that it's going to be honky-dory when they go back, but it isn't. It is for some and it is for others. But we survived, and I did a lot of development down there. I got a submission done for an Aboriginal Medical Centre, which was the first one on missions. So, you know, we did a lot of work, and it was time to leave, and then I come up here to the Central Coast. Well, I'm glad I did, because I thought I did the wrong thing coming up here too, but because I never liked being on the Central Coast. I liked being out near the rivers and the water, you know, the creeks and the desert land.
Social outreach has been a constant in your life, personally and professionally. We heard about the drug and alcohol counselling earlier. What else has been involved?
The Aboriginal Legal Service. I worked there as a cleaner because I was drinking then. And then I worked my way up to be a director. And then one day the CEO wanted me to take over the CEO position. So from there I worked my way up to be my solicitor's boss. So they were very proud of me because they dealt with me when I used to be drink driving and all these silly things that you do when you're drunk. And so I ended up being their, you know, boss over their pay packets and stuff. Then I got offered a drug and alcohol position, and I was in the hotel and I was just having a drink, and the lady walked in and said, would you be my drug and alcohol counselor? And I nearly dropped the drink. I said, how do you want me to be? You know I drink. She said, that's the best one. You've walked it, you talked it, you lived it, and you know the community. So at first I thought the community wouldn't believe. I never drank after that drink. I never even finished it. I said, well, if you've got that faith in me, I will honour it. And it was funny because some of the guys and girls I used to drink with would come in going to court, and I'd say, when did you have your first drink? They'd say, you know, Arnie, we had it with you. Oh, don't say that. Don't go into court saying that.
Diane, it's been, you know, you've worked, I think, in the areas of diabetes and asthma. You ran a needle syringe exchange program. I think you were chief executive of the Aboriginal Medical Service, so extraordinary service. And then in 2017, you were named New South Wales Grandmother of the Year. Did you see that one coming?
No. But a friend of mine put in that application, and I said, oh, you're naughty doing that. And she said, well, you deserve it. She said, look what you've done, not only for your own kids, but for everyone else's kids. I said, fair enough. So I didn't think we'd win. And then we won that one. Then I got my on one no doc day, we got, because of her, we can, on my face up on the central station clock with five other people going around, and that was a great honour, seeing that for the whole Sydney to see. Well, the whole world, I think, seen that one.
What has discovering you were Yorta Yorta brought to your life?
My culture, my history, our birth lines, everything, the song lines, our dream time, everything that William Cooper has wrote up. And sometimes I feel that Pa's here with me all the time, because when I get up talking about land council, my aunties say to me, "You just sound like your grandfather, great-grandfather." But I don't realise that. I'm just talking the way I talk, you know, and just say what I feel. And I always say, you've got to divide it, we fall, united we stand. And they've got to stand up and be counted. We need to educate our kids to get into Parliament so then we can make changes, because we're not doing very good.
That is our guest, Diane O'Brien, and her memoir, Daughter of the River Country.